This podcast contains adult language and stories of true crime. If you don't like laughing, crying, or being horrified at the actions of other humans, this podcast is not for you.
Right.
Take two.
Take two.
Hey, everybody.
Hey, it's everybody. Us again.
I think we should go ahead and say that this is the second time we're recording.
It's the second intro. Time that we're recording this intro and the first segment because that's why we can't have nice things.
Technical difficulties.
We've been recording for 40 minutes and it's lost to the void. No one will ever hear it. Okay, so this is season 4, episode 12 of Resolve Mysteries, and this is the show where we rewatch, recap, and give you the latest updates to cases featured on the show Unsolved Mysteries. I'm Eliza.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Carlin.
And welcome. We're happy you're here again, because I already told you that, but you don't know it. As most of you know, for every review we receive, we donate a dollar to a different organization, and this month's is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which was suggested to us by our patron, Matthew. So thank you, Matthew, and we're happy to help support them, and you can help support us and them by leaving a review. Speaking of patrons, we have a couple to shout out, so thank you to Valeria F. and Rachel R. for supporting us. And if you want to go to patreon.com/resolvemysteriespodcast, you will get access to like over 40 episodes, correct?
Over 80.
Yes.
Can you believe we have been doing this?
Oh, really quick.
40 times two?
Yeah.
Really quick. This is like around last week was our 3-year anniversary.
Aww. Wow.
Happy anniversary, girls. You're welcome.
It's like I'm a president. It's like I'm Obama, and I've aged into this presidency. You can tell.
You have gray hair now.
I see. I was like, wow, really self-inflicted over there.
You guys, I'm Beyonce, and it's just awesome.
Eliza is clearly the Obama of this podcast.
No, you know, when they become president, then they just age a million years.
Yeah, it just sucks the life out of them. Mm-hmm. So happy anniversary.
We do all have more gray hair about it, so.
So this is a 3-segment episode. So we just have one epi for episode 12, and we are covering some juicy cases.
So we have the wanted segment of Michael St. Clair and Dennis Reese.
And then we have the unexplained death of Dan Tondevald.
And a last loves about Jim Curry looking for his mom.
Okay, do you guys want to do this all over again?
Yeah, let's do it again.
Oh my God, you know, it was so much fun the first time. I can't wait to do it again.
Yeah, I'm so excited. All right, can't wait.
Here we go. Okay, got my stuff.
Okay, great.
All right, ready?
Ready.
Okay, so the first segment of season 4, episode 12 is a wanted segment. And the segment begins with a prison scene. The prisoner is calling to a guard and the guard replies, yeah, Sinclair, what do you want? And Robert Stack says on September 19th, 1991, two-time convicted killer Michael St. Clair orchestrated a daring escape from the Bryan County Jail in Durant, Oklahoma. St. Clair released a fellow inmate named Dennis Reese, who was awaiting trial for robbery and murder. Stack says that that night, Michael St. Clair and Dennis Reese ignited a murderous crime spree that has stretched across at least 8 states and has left at least 4 dead in its wake.
And, like, this is why the show was really scary for people at the time. Because sometimes they were like, this guy's still out there murdering
and
everyone.
Could literally be anywhere.
Yeah, yep. And could be in any state because they already went to 8 states. So
just keep your eyes open, everybody.
Yeah.
And thanks for your help.
Yeah. And then Stack says to please watch carefully, you may help save someone's life. So then they show footage of Michael St. Clair in a courtroom, and he is the smuggest dick bitch that you have ever seen. Yeah, he has, like, the definition of a punchable face. Like, you just want to sink your fist into his doughy, smirky, smug face. So Stack tells us that less than 3 months before his escape, St. Clair was convicted on 2 counts of first-degree murder and was sentenced to 3 consecutive life prison terms. Bob Ricks says that Michael St. Clair has been involved with various drug trafficking organizations in southern Oklahoma as well as northern Texas. Ricks says that St. Clair's uncle was moving in on his drug operations, and he felt his profits were being threatened. So he contracted out to have his uncle killed.
What a family.
Just a true sweetie. So after his uncle was killed, St. Clair then assassinated the hitman.
Wait.
Usually you're getting a hitman so that you're not the one doing a murder.
Yep. The best way to keep a secret between two people is if one of them is dead. So Stack says that 2 days after the fugitives escaped, Tom Mullins, a newspaper reporter, received a chilling phone call from Michael St. Clair. Tom Mullins, who sounds like Sam Shepard and has the mustache to prove it, says that for almost 20 months now, he has covered Michael St. Clair and has gotten to know him fairly well. In the reenactment, it shows Tom Mullins licking the back of a bug, like a like a recording device, and then placing it on the phone. Like he licks it the way you would lick the back of a suction cup.
No.
And I find it super funny that they bothered to show that in the reenactment.
No.
That's what you used to have to do. If you wanted to record a phone call, you had to get your tongue in there, lick that suction cup, stick it on the back of the phone, and be like, okay, I'm recording. Clap on three.
Maybe the problem is that none of us licked our mics before we started.
I think that's probably it.
Oh, that's why.
We didn't lick the software, you know?
Yeah.
The software needs a little...
next time we're going to lick on three.
Clap on three, lick on three.
Mullen says that he has gotten to know St. Clair fairly well. And Mullen says that, quote, when he got out, but I think he means when he broke out of prison with another murderer, Mullins was the obvious choice to hear St. Clair's message. That message being that he wouldn't be taken alive when the time came. If any law enforcement came around, his quote was, anyone wearing a badge, I'll kill. Mm. Stack says that 3 weeks later, near Elizabethtown, Kentucky, a state trooper pulled over a pickup truck, which was seen fleeing from a burning vehicle. Paul Renfro of the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation says that the pickup truck came to a halt. As the truck pulled over, the man on the passenger side, who he now believes was St. Clair, got out of the vehicle and fired at the state trooper. Fortunately, the trooper was not injured. Within just a matter of minutes, the maroon truck was found abandoned and disabled along the interstate. It had crossed the interstate and in doing so had blown both front tires. Stack tells us that the truck belonged to 56-year-old Francis Brady, a retired distillery worker and a father of three. He had disappeared hours earlier after cashing a check at a convenience store. Bob Ricks says that Brady's body was found approximately 12 hours north of Elizabethtown, Kentucky. Brady had been shot execution style. He had been handcuffed and shot in the head.
Jeez.
What is remarkable about this execution is that it is almost identical to the way Michael St. Clair's uncle, Ronnie St. Clair, had been executed a few years before.
That's so strange.
Yeah. It's almost like he learned something from the hitman he murdered. Stack says that the other truck that St. Clair and Reese had set fire to belonged to a Denver paramedic named Tim Keeling. Like Brady, Keeling also vanished after patronizing a convenience store. His body was found in a roadside ditch outside of Clayton, New Mexico. So we'll get into it. But as far as the segment's concerned, Oklahoma, Kentucky, New Mexico. I don't know if you're familiar with the U.S. map, but those are sort of a distance from each other. Mm-hmm. 5 days after firing on the state trooper, Michael St. Clair and Dennis Reese apparently struck again, this time in Tennessee. The two men, matching their descriptions, robbed a video store in Milan, Tennessee. They brutally executed the clerk, who was a 20-year-old mother of two. 30 minutes later, the same two men robbed another video store just 8 miles away. Again, the young female clerk was gunned down in cold blood.
Just terrible. Just doesn't need to happen.
Relentless. Yeah. Rick says that individuals that would kill for $100, $150, or $200 are extremely desperate individuals. Rick says that these people are constantly moving and they are very concerned about staying in one location for a period of time. They're very paranoid and very dangerous and will do anything to prevent their apprehension.
One might argue they're not very paranoid if they're just killing people everywhere they go.
Well, I think he means they're very paranoid about leaving witnesses behind.
Mm. Yeah.
So there's an update in the show. Michael St. Clair and Dennis Reese were eventually captured. And then for the murder of Frank Brady, St. Clair was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And Dennis Reese was convicted of murder and kidnapping and was sentenced to life in prison. After the breakout is detailed in court testimony, documents, and lots of interviews with St. Clair and Reese. They've actually spoken to the press a lot over the years. The articles that I have range from, I think, 1991 to 2015. I have some sources, but all of the sources are obviously in our episode notes. So the most recent interview with Reese came in June of 2014 when he called the AP in response to a letter sent to him almost 18 months ago. Apparently, once they broke out of the prison, the pair stole a truck from a jail employee. Then another truck when the first vehicle ran out of gas. They fled to Texas and then boarded a Greyhound bus that took them to Denver, where they came across Keeling outside a grocery store. St. Clair and Reese posed as buyers interested in purchasing Keeling's truck, and then they kidnapped him. Reese drove as Keeling sat next to him, and St. Clair held a .357 Magnum revolver in the passenger seat. During the drive, Keeling showed Reese and St. Clair pictures of his 18-month-old niece and talked about his life.
Mm, no.
That makes me think that they told him that they were going to let him go. As they approached Clayton, New Mexico, a small crossroads town, St. Clair told Reese that he had to pee and told Keeling to get out with him. Reese said that St. Clair shot Keeling twice before returning to the truck. Quote, he told me that shooting people was like shooting dogs. Once you killed one, the rest was easy.
Okay.
Reese said that he was afraid to protest the shooting. Quote, I know Michael. He would have shot me just as quick as he shot everybody else. He needed me to drive. That's all. I didn't ever even have a gun. St. Clair and Reese headed east through Texas, stopping in New Orleans for a few days before taking Keeling's truck north through Tennessee, where law enforcement has identified them as the main suspects in the death of two store clerks. Later in Kentucky, they kidnapped and killed distillery worker Frank Brady near Elizabethtown after ditching and burning Keeling's truck. So, Michael St. Clair is a piece of shit, and he is just an unrepentant nightmare person. It's insane. St. Clair likes to talk a lot, and he loves to talk to the press. So at some point, while he was on the run, St. Clair telephoned reporters at the Durant, Oklahoma Daily Democrat, boasting about his prowess with guns and promising not to be taken alive. He claimed to be related to the outlaw Jesse James.
Oh, no.
Just if like you're Carlin.
If you're an OG listener, you will know that I also claimed that at one time in my life. And I'm very embarrassed now to be associated with this guy.
Well, you're bonded by blood now.
Blood relatives, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah, yeah, long last relative. I think that's a Billy the Kid episode, actually.
Oh, no.
Oh, and then also St. Clair accompanied one call to the newspaper with a recording of the theme song from the Dukes of Hazzard.
Okay.
So he basically, like, played himself into the phone call. He played the intro and then got on the phone.
Disgusting.
I just hate everything about it.
Yes. And if you are one of our younger listeners, The Dukes of Hazzard was a 1980s television series about rural Southerners who dodge corrupt, dim-witted lawmen in a souped-up car with the Confederate flag on the hood. And that's all you really need to know about The Dukes of Hazzard.
Yep.
Michael St. Clair was armed with an AR-15 assault rifle and hiding in the second floor of a home when dozens of FBI agents and state police served a search warrant shortly after midnight. Authorities negotiated with St. Clair for about half an hour before he surrendered, said Bob Ricks, special agent in charge of the FBI in Oklahoma. He broke out a back window and then went onto the roof, but went back inside when he saw police guarding the rear of the house. St. Clair's brother, Hansel, was arrested and charged later for harboring a fugitive. Quote, "I believe he's the most dangerous of the two, and we're extremely relieved that he's in custody," said Kentucky State Police Detective John Carr. So, over the years, the legal process hasn't been very kind to Brady's family. This is from an article from 2010 from WHAS 11. Michael St. Clair calls himself the $5 million man, referring to how much taxpayer money has been spent on his trials.
No.
Wow. Everyone's so proud.
Mm-hmm. St. Clair was in jail in Oklahoma on two murder convictions when he escaped and killed three more people, including Francis Brady. The Supreme Court overturned his death sentence in 2010, saying the trial court incorrectly instructed a jury. This is a major blow to the Brady family that was blindsided by tragedy. Quote, "We always lived by his words, do the right thing and don't give up," Melanie Brady Drury, his daughter, said. It's the motto of Francis Brady. Michael St. Clair, the man convicted of her father's case and twice sentenced to death, has successfully appealed both decisions, avoiding execution. Melanie calls it a mockery of her father's death. Quote, "It's kind of the name of the game at this point. It's always changing. It's always upset. It's always something else that has been thrown into it, a technicality." Mm. Her 75-year-old mother, Merle, says that she hopes she lives long enough to see this through. Quote, "I am ready and willing to go through another trial in Hardin County and another sentence phase in Bullitt County." In an interview with the News and Enterprise, Michael St. Clair said, "Since May 11th, 1995, I've been housed in Kentucky at the taxpayers' expense. Hee-haw! Now, here it is, 2010, and I am still not dead."
Ugh.
Michael St. Clair says he's innocent. Melanie Brady Drury says, quote, "How many chances has he gotten, and how many chances did my dad get to escape him?" So, in 2012, Kentucky prosecutors were working for two decades to make a death sentence stick against Michael St. Clair. And they succeeded in persuading a judge yet again to apply the death penalty against St. Clair for the 1991 kidnapping of Francis Brady. In Elizabethtown, Special Judge Thomas O'Caslin ordered St. Clair to be executed for the 1991 kidnapping murder. Prosecutors had sought a death sentence in Hardin County because that's where Brady was last seen. Caslin also sentenced St. Clair to 35 years in prison for receiving stolen property, criminal attempted murder, and criminal facilitation of arson. The judge set an execution date of March 30th, 2012, but prosecutors said that will likely be stayed as St. Clair appeals. St. Clair is also under death sentence in neighboring Bullitt County. A judge in November of 2012 condemned him for the murder in Brady's death. Brady's widow, Merle Brady, attended the court hearing, watching as the defendant insulted the court. She said later that the case is far from over, expecting years of appeals by the man convicted of her husband's death. Mm. Quote, "It's been a long journey. It really has. This is not the end. We'll hang in there. I'm not a quitter." During the sentence hearing, St. Clair chatted with his attorneys but did not look at Merle Brady as she sat in the courtroom gallery. St. Clair vowed to make the court and everyone else wait while he appealed and pledged to win a new trial from the Kentucky Supreme Court. Quote, "I've been waiting 20 years for a fair trial, Judge, and of all the trials I've seen, Judge, yours is the worstest," St. Clair told the judge.
Oh my
God. Merle Brady wasn't surprised by St. Clair's comments to Judge Caslin. "There's a lot of evil in the world, and I think he's an evil man."
Yeah, I agree.
Once St. Clair and Reese were convicted, Lisa Hill, the widow of Timothy Keeling, who was murdered in New Mexico, began to urge a New Mexico district attorney to secure indictments against St. Clair and Dennis Reese on the charges of capital murder and kidnapping in the death of 22-year-old Timothy Keeling. So Lisa Hill was widowed at the age of 21. Mm-hmm. And Tim was only 22. Hill was interviewed by a local newspaper, and she said, quote, "Should they spend time in a New Mexico jail? Absolutely. Should they be given the death penalty? Absolutely." Reese and St. Clair had long been suspected in the death of Keeling. Reese admitted his role in the death, but he says he didn't pull the trigger. St. Clair, of course, denies the charges. In a phone call to the Associated Press, Reese said that he doesn't plan to contest the extradition. Reese says, quote, "It ain't no use to fight it. I'm guilty. I just want to get this over with." However, St. Clair's attorney in New Mexico said his client, of course, plans to fight the charges.
Can you imagine being his attorney?
Oh, I know.
Like, what the hell? Why do you want to spend your time doing that?
I know. Gosh, defense attorneys, it's very complicated.
Yeah.
His defense attorney, Stephen McGillen, said, quote, "Michael is taking a very active role in his defense."
Yeah.
By being a total dick.
Yep.
In letters and phone calls with the Associated Press over the last 4 years, St. Clair has admitted to four slayings in Oklahoma, for which he is serving time, but repeatedly denies killing Keating. Quote, "I didn't shoot that boy in New Mexico," St. Clair said in a 2010 phone call. "They tried to hang me on it, but I didn't do it." The probe of Keeling's death sat dormant as Kentucky and Oklahoma prosecuted the men for their crimes. District Attorney Donald Gallegos, whose territory covers Clayton, New Mexico, said initial decisions to not pursue the case were made before he took office. Gallegos said that Hill's efforts prompted him to pull the file, which had been marked as dismissed. He started the investigation anew and issued indictments in April of 2012. Now, Gallegos has the responsibility of returning St. Clair and Reese to New Mexico to stand trial. Quote, "I think if things go the way they'll go, they'll never serve time in New Mexico. But my job is not to seek convictions. It is to seek justice." Reese said to the AP, quote, "I wish I could change what happened, but I can't." His remorse is of little comfort to Hill. She says, quote, "Closure will never really come. When you know someone like Tim, when someone like him touches your life, closure never really comes. Instead, you just learn to cope." In 2013, Reese was sentenced to 30 years in prison for the murder of Timothy. After sentencing, Reese turned to Hill and said, quote, "I'm sorry." "I forgive you," she told Reese, "but it's not okay." St. Clair's case will not be as easy as Reese's to convict. Hill would like New Mexico to pursue the death penalty for St. Clair, but that won't happen. Gallegos said that he looked at a number of issues, time and costs, and the fact that St. Clair already has a death sentence, and made his decision not to pursue it. At the same court hearing, at which Hill had a chance to tell Reese that she forgave him, St. Clair also addressed the widow. Quote, "Lady, I didn't kill your husband."
I feel like you should be able to say, "I don't want to hear anything this person has to say to me."
I think that,
yeah.
I have heard podcast episodes where they say that the family will get up and leave before the person makes a statement.
They have a right to make a statement.
Okay. Yeah. They have the right to make the statement, but the family doesn't have to stay there and listen.
Okay.
Yeah. But good news is, in 2014, St. Clair was convicted in the case. Interestingly, though, for unknown reasons, neither St. Clair nor Reese were ever charged with the murders of Kathy Stutes or Tammy Tidwell, who were the two female clerks that they murdered at the video store.
Why?
And I think, like, it's because maybe they were already convicted and sentenced to life and sentenced to death, that maybe the DAs don't want to spend the money and the time convicting them for these other murders. But then it doesn't really seem fair to family of those murder victims that those people in prison aren't serving justice for the murder of the people that they love.
Yeah. Like, they may have some comfort in knowing he's sentenced, but...
Yeah. So he's off the streets and he won't hurt anybody else, but he isn't being sentenced for what he did to the person that you care about.
Right. Yeah.
That's so sad.
Yeah. And that's pretty much it. There is a strange aside. Francis Dury's youngest daughter, a woman named Melissa Sloan, sadly also went missing and has never been found. Her ex-husband is a suspect in her murder. And my heart really goes out to the Brady family.
Family, yeah.
Seriously.
I mean, how much suffering can one family have?
That's awful.
Yeah, so that is the interstate, completely bananas, on the run, hella violent, dick bitch, Michael St. Clair, and his probably equally as shitty, but I guess a little bit less shitty counterpart, Dennis Reese.
Yeah.
Hate him.
Yeah.
Hate him.
Not good.
Michael Sinclair is just an unrepentant monster. I mean, he clearly gets off. He talks to the press all of the time.
Gross.
He's constantly, like, jabbing at the families. He's just the worst.
Yeah, he has the nerve to, like, make up a nickname for themselves.
Yes.
About this.
And brag about it.
Yeah. I know. And then it seems like Dennis Reese, like, I do believe him when he says that he was afraid of Sinclair. So And it seems like he's at least apologized for what he's done, even though it's too late to take it back kind of thing.
And I do really think he probably would have hopped out way earlier if he felt like he could do so without getting killed.
I mean, Michael Sinclair was just murdering everybody he saw. So I could see being like, I had to do it.
Yeah. You know? He will kill me.
He will kill me.
Yeah.
So that's it.
Well, good job. Hated it just as much the second time.
Okay. This is an unexplained death, but it's, I mean, with the way that UM tells it, it's actually more of a missing persons. So that choice is interesting. And Stack starts by telling us that Tennessee is, quote, dotted with majestic antebellum estates.
Oh, right.
Right.
Yes. Then he says, a type of aristocracy still thrives here, and Ellen McClung Berry is typical of the upper crust group.
Oh, I hate.
Which is a sentence crust. I have multiple problems with.
Yuck.
But we're just going to move past that for now. So in the reenactment, we have Mrs. Berry, and she's wearing a very loud 70s print floral dress. She's got a long string of pearls, and she has a large-brimmed red-orange sun hat.
Yeah, she does.
And she's sitting outside at a table in front of her mansion.
Mm-hmm.
She's reading the paper. Her maid comes out with a fancy silver tray of a tea set. And there's more flowers on the tray. Like, it's all very, very fancy.
Dream.
And, you know, some people live like this.
Yep, apparently.
So, Stack says by 1978, when she was 85 years old, Mrs. Berry lived in solitary splendor on a mountaintop outside the city of Knoxville, which had been founded by her great-great-grandfather.
I want to live in a life of solitary splendor.
Yes. And the grandfather, they don't mention this, but the grandfather founded Knoxville.
Oh, what?
So she is old money.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Okay.
Yes. Not only has she never been poor, no one in her family has ever been poor. Arthur Pete Ballard, Mrs. Berry's friend, who's like a middle-aged man, says she would be considered one of the local grand dames of the old school, and probably there were not many. Pete says, that means you can live on the mountain like she did and have everybody come to you like Muhammad.
Oh, I get it now.
It's just that simple, he says as he laughs.
I didn't get it when he first said that.
Yeah. I'm curious. I should have looked up maybe like what the mountain is, because I think there was like surrounding town, but she was pretty isolated being
That's amazing.
Up there. So.
That's dream. Amazing. Yeah. Love it.
Happy for her.
Very happy for her. So Stack then tells us about one person who did come see Mrs. Berry up on the mountain in 1978, and that person was Dan Tondebold. Stack describes Tondebold as vaguely mysterious and claiming to be from Denmark.
How can you be vaguely mysterious?
I know.
Either are or you aren't mysterious.
Yes, and I think like that vague mystery, whatever element was the town's perception, not necessarily Mrs. Berry's. So he does say that he and Mrs. Berry were in correspondence for 15 years, but no one ever knew exactly what their relationship was. Mm-hmm. Sometimes she would refer to him as her godson, and sometimes she would say he was a friend of her late son, Hugh. They show a reenactment of him coming to see her, and she's so happy, and they're hugging, and it's all very jovial. So then we go back to Pete's interview, and Pete says, I just had a feeling that this kid was bad news, but he was making Ellen happy. He says that he was just happy to see her happy, and he was glad there was someone there with her on the mountain in case something happened to her and she couldn't get help. So Mrs. Berry's former aide, which I think is kind of a very general term, I think these people did a lot for her.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Berry's former aide, Marcia Robinson, said he was taking the place of her son. She says that he looked like her son, which she felt was the attraction to him. So I don't know, because they do show a side-by-side of the two guys, and
they don't really look alike.
I don't really see it.
No.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, it's, to me, it's not like, oh, he's a lookalike.
I did think the reenactor looked a lot like the guy, the real Tondewald guy.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah, agree on that. So anyway, Marcia thinks that Dan started playing this role of her son, and that's why Mrs. Berry was involved with him. So at this point, I'm thinking that's so sad. She lost her child. She must have missed him so much.
Right.
And then they tell us about Hugh. And in 1951, when he was 18, he, quote, flew into a rage over his inheritance and killed his grandmother with a shotgun.
Ugh, Jesus.
And I was like, what?
Yeah.
Crazy. So no matter the reason, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah. Truly.
And it just had me spinning about people feeling entitled to money that's not theirs. And it's just, it's getting wild in this story.
Yeah.
So then Stack tells us that a judge ruled Hugh incompetent to stand trial. So then I was like, okay, maybe he was really mentally ill. And now I feel bad about everything I just thought about this guy. But honestly, we just do not know enough of the story to have a very informed opinion. So Stack then tells us that Hugh was lobotomized and sent to live in Mexico.
What the fuck?
Whoa.
So this family history is getting crazy.
Yeah, crazy.
Oh, man.
And I was like, I understand him being sent somewhere else, but a lobotomy and being sent out of the country?
Like they did that to Rosemary Kennedy. People used, rich people did that all the time. Yeah, a lobotomy was an answer to rich everything people. For them back
yep.
then.
Yeah, they were like, we'll get into that.
Put a stick up their nose, scramble it, and send them away. And let's never talk about them again. We'll never speak of them again.
Yeah. So it's like, either if he wasn't incompetent, he got what was coming to him. And if he was incompetent, this is the most tragic story ever. And then Stack says on New Year's Eve 1963, Mr. and Mrs. Berry found out that he had died of pneumonia. Stack says that later, Mrs. Berry had hinted he'd actually committed suicide.
I don't know if people with lobotomies take their own life.
I don't know.
Yeah. We're going to get into it a little.
Oh, okay. Cool. Because I feel like there's
I never thought of that.
Movie, I don't know what it is, that I've watched that, like, it doesn't affect everyone the same way.
Mm. It does not.
Okay.
And there actually have been successful lobotomies as well.
Huh. Oh, that work. Or this.
Yes.
Okay.
It had to have worked at some point because everybody was doing it all the time.
God.
Yes. Yes, some of them did work. I looked into it for a while because I was like, holy fuck, what's going on with lobotomies?
Dude. I would have done that too. I would have done the same thing.
So, according to Hugh's friends, his body was never returned to the U.S., and Mr. Berry died in 1978, and Mrs. Berry had been alone since then.
Wow.
So, gonna interject some research here that I found from this writer named Damian Moore for AmericanCrimeJournal.com. And I'll swing back again and talk about him and this research later, because I'm gonna reference it quite a bit. So, Hugh Lawson McClung was Ellen and Thomas's only son. By the time he was 5, he was sent away to prep school. Mm. So he was with his parents 3 months of the year during summer break and 2 weeks during Christmas.
Oh, my God.
And when he was home, the maids took care of him.
Oh, boy.
And, quote, some say Ellen and Thomas did not show him very much affection.
Oh.
So gives you a little precursor there on, like, this scenario.
Yep.
And then this was the detail that he had found about the events in 1951.
Okay.
So in 1951, at the Berry's winter home in West Palm Beach, Florida, their now 18-year-old son, Hugh, took a .410 shotgun and shot his grandmother, Ella, with birdshot in the chest, stomach, and arm.
Wait, how old was he?
18.
He then turned the shotgun on Thomas. Thomas is Ellen's husband, a.k.a. his father.
Oh, shit. He was going to kill everybody.
He shot his father in the face and chest.
What?
Mm-hmm. He then took off, triggering one of the largest manhunts in Florida's history at the time.
What?
A patrolman spotted Hugh Barry armed with a shotgun running across West Palm Beach Country Club and gave chase, and he was shot in the leg.
Oh, my God.
And Hugh managed to escape. But then Hugh was caught shortly after and claimed that he was, quote, being disinherited of $600,000, and that was his reason for the rampage.
Okay. Wow.
His grandmother, Ella, passed away from her injuries 9 days later, but his dad, Thomas, survived.
Wow. The face and the chest.
Yeah, and it was birdshot, so that's
the scatter.
Lots of tiny little bullets. Scatter shot. So I think it was probably like lots of injury, but not enough to kill him, obviously.
Wow.
And then one thing I had read said that Ellen thought that this was all due to a brain injury Hugh had had 3 years earlier.
Oh.
But that's not what everybody thinks. Mm-hmm. So Moore says that, Moore is this writer who wrote about this, says that as was often done in wealthy families, if a child had physical or mental disabilities or if they brought any kind of shame to the family, they'd be sent off. And this is what happened to Hugh.
Yeah.
So mental health professionals at the time determined that Hugh had suffered from dementia praecox, which is a term we do not use anymore. But it basically described the onset of psychosis unrelated to a brain injury.
Okay.
Moore says, from what I've read, the term was used for young people in their late teens to early 20s who suffered a psychotic episode, which today we know can be a result of, like, many different disorders. Mm-hmm. He was sent to a state hospital until a private one opened in Chicago. So I definitely read the Chicago thing in multiple sources. So for a time, he was in Chicago, like, in an institution. So I'm not sure how or when he ended up in Mexico, but it doesn't sound like he was just cast out of the country. Like, right. I don't think that's exactly what happened. But apparently there's just not much info about Hugh after that point.
Okay.
Quote, this is Moore again. Some suspect that Hugh may have had a lobotomy after the shooting incident. While controversial then, the procedure was extremely popular at the time, especially in state mental institutions and prisons, and among the wealthy for children they felt were abnormal or undisciplined.
Yeah, man.
And then just to put it in perspective with my rabbit hole about lobotomies, we stopped doing those in the late 60s. Like, technically, they're still done in a much different way and on a much different scale. But that type of lobotomy stopped in the late 60s. So this wasn't that long before that.
I was listening to a podcast, and I can't remember what it was, but the doctor who, like, invented lobotomies or something, they recorded him doing a tremendous amount of lobotomies in a day. He, like, prided himself on how quickly he could do them.
Ew. Yes.
And he would go around and they'd line the patients up and he would just clink, 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 like into their heads. And it was like,
I think we've talked about this. Yeah.
Yeah. It was, I can't remember what podcast it was because I don't usually listen to like science podcasts. But yeah, he was like a real showman about it. And definitely part of the appeal was how quickly and how many lobotomies he could do at a time.
Mm-mm. Yes. And didn't people like come to watch?
Yeah.
Like, people
there was an audience for it. Yeah. People would come and watch. They would record it. But yeah, for some reason, I remember that. Sorry.
It's terrible. So, but we do know Hugh did die of pneumonia in Mexico on New Year's Eve in 1963. He was only 31. But then there is this rumor that Hugh actually committed suicide. And Ellen had lied about the reason of his death in order to protect the family name. So I don't really know which one's true. So then back to our whole thing that this segment is about. Very coincidentally, the same year that Mr. Barry died, Thomas Barry, was the same year that Dan Tondebald appeared and moved into Mrs. Barry's guest house. Hmm. He then began taking care of the day-to-day operations of the estate. The Barry estate atop a mountain was creatively named Barry Mount. Sack says that before long, Tondebald made himself indispensable to Mrs. Barry. My first thought was, there's this woman, she's been widowed, she's in her 80s, she's suddenly responsible for this giant estate by herself. And it's not so long ago that I assume she had nothing to do with the business or anything like that, but she's a wealthy woman who's had a lot done for her over the years, so yeah. I just kind of assumed her hands aren't in the dirty work of it.
Yeah,
you know?
Of course.
She's probably feeling super lost and like there's a lot to do and overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. And so this was just like this perfect timing for Tondebald to appear and like save her from all of it.
Yes, it's a very savior complex.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to appreciate him.
a lot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And be blinded, maybe.
Yes. So Stack says, not only was Tondebald running Barrowmount, he was running her. So there's a reenactment of him coming in and telling her, he's like, oh, I've got some checks for you to sign. And she's like, oh, of course. I'm so grateful you're doing this for me. I had no idea the estate was in such disrepair.
Oh, my God.
So UM is definitely painting this picture of Tondebald being this master manipulator, earning Mrs. Barry's trust and love and using it to get things out of her.
Mm. Yeah.
Stack tells us that Mrs. Barry also started catering to Dan's stupid rich white guy hobby of expensive show horses.
Yes. My God. Did you see the way that one of those horses was prancing in that ring?
It was full on prancing. So enter Dan in the reenactment. He is the preppiest. He is wearing this baby blue polo, pleated khakis, white sweater tied over the shoulders like it is just country club douchery.
80s movie villain attire.
Yes. By 1983, Dan owned a stable of 7 Tennessee Walkers. You know, those prancy dance horses.
The pranciest, but only prancing with the front legs, not
yes.
the back legs.
That's part of the whole show. I don't get it, but
the fronts are curved this the whole time.
So Eliza's reenacting the prancing at this
I've
moment.
Never seen this. So you had seen this before.
Yes.
I was like, yes. What the fuck is wrong with that animal?
And I think that's what a Tennessee Walker is. They do these like fancy walks. Yeah. They don't do like, they're not racing.
Can they also walk normally or they just walk like that? So how do you tell it to do that?
They probably walk normal.
When they're off the clock, they just strut. They just walk
around.
How
do they train them to do that?
I don't know. Apparently it costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they just tell them to do it, and then they say, okay, now you can walk normal, and you don't have to look like an idiot anymore? It's crazy. We should put a video. We should, on the Instagram, we should... Not, it cannot just be a photo. It needs to be a picture, a video.
We'll do it. So he has 7 of these Tennessee Walkers, and of course, Mrs. Barry paid for Dan to have these. And he named all of them Barrymount with a number to
Ew.
Correspond. So they were Barrymount 1 through 7.
Oh, okay.
It's like the George Foreman of Prancy Dancy Horses.
Yes. Prancy Dance 1 through 7. So Stack says it soon became a $1 million hobby.
Oh, don't you love those $1 million hobbies?
I have so many of them. So.
I mean, second only to podcasting, truly.
Truly.
But so then we have an interview with Dan Tondebald's assistant. They don't say former assistant. They say assistant Charlene Freeman, who definitely looks like she emptied a container of highlighter on her face and just smeared it around.
Oh, I need a picture.
Eliza and I were just talking about this. I look really shiny right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, you look great.
When you record, I always look shiny.
You look super dewy. I love it.
But this woman was like shiny. Oh, and she's also got sprinkler bangs. So
oh, I love it.
I love it. Everything about it. So Charlene Freeman says that Mrs. Barry told her that Mr. Tondebald's hobby did not make a dent in her fortune, and it was a hobby she wanted him to have.
Okay.
I think that probably wasn't true. I think Tondebald was saying that to her. Like, oh, you have so much money that this hobby is hardly anything.
Right.
So that's who she was getting her financial information from. So it probably was putting a huge dent in her finances.
She didn't know how much money she had, number
one,
and how much money he was spending.
Exactly. Yep.
Stack says it's as if Dan Tondebald had put a spell over Mrs. Barry, and in 1982, she granted him power of attorney.
Oh, no.
Back to her friend, Pete Ballard, and he says she was a willing pigeon, so to speak.
Mm.
He says that he thinks others have had tried to tell her that the situation with Dan didn't make sense and that something might be wrong and that he might be a con artist, and she just ignored it. So at this point in the segment, I'm starting to feel like she's just afraid to be alone. And she thought, what's the harm in letting him buy some things?
Right.
And he started taking advantage of that. So in 1984, Tondebald talked Mrs. Barry into taking a vacation to Charleston, South Carolina.
Dream.
Before they left, Tondewald put in a classified ad for a chauffeur. But UM shows a quick screen grab of it, but they don't read it aloud. And we must read it aloud.
We must.
This is not the whole thing, but I pulled a few key sentences. It says, male houseman chauffeur, valet for East Country Estate, two-member family, non-smoker, single, non-fat, and must like the privacy of the country. Write with personal details and include picture if possible.
What? Oh, he doesn't need a chauffeur. He needs a boyfriend.
I know. I was like, I'm sorry. Is this a classified ad or a personal ad?
Yes.
And Stack tells us that he placed the ad secretly in the Charleston papers. Nobody else knew about it.
Yeah, that was code.
So after 4 months in Charleston, they head back home to Tennessee. And the plan was that Tondewald would send Mrs. Barry and her companion on a plane to fly back, and he would drive back the Mercedes.
Okay. Rich people making plans.
Rich people making rich people plans. So Mrs. Barry and the companion come back in the house. Mrs. Barry immediately is like, I'm pretty sure we left the lights on. Yeah. All the lights are out. She then picks up the phone. She soon realizes that all the utilities are cut off. So then we cut to a reenactment of Mrs. Barry speaking to, I don't know if they're like lawyers or her financial team or something like that, but they're telling her what has happened. They tell her she is pretty much bankrupt and that Tondewald also borrowed $85,000 against the estate. Stack says that for the first time in her life, Mrs. Barry had a mortgage to pay, and for the first time in her life, she had no way to pay it.
That is so, I mean, terrible.
The fact that he took so much money that they turned the utilities off, he took everything.
Yeah, everything.
Everything. They shut the phone off.
Evil.
He didn't have to do that.
No.
He could have left her with $5,000 or something. Yeah. You know, like he could have left her with just enough to live.
Yes.
And he didn't even do that.
Yeah. And this old woman who has never had to do 85. This. So she doesn't know how to get money or pay for things. Like,
it's awful. Yeah. She's 85 years old. Oh my God. It's so terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so Dan Smith of the White Pine, Tennessee Police Department says that her accounts were empty. Quote, he just gutted her, took away her wealth and her pride and everything. So by all accounts in the UM telling of this, Tondewald just has himself a grand old time with his money. He's traveling around, staying at expensive hotels and racking up huge bills. He was about 100 miles from Charleston at a hotel on Fripp Island, South Carolina, when the credit cards maxed out. So they do a reenactment of the guy at the desk, and he's like, your bills are pretty large. We're going to have you start paying some of these. So he's like, oh, no problem. Let me go back to my villa and get a check to pay you. He, of course, does not return. The next day, a suicide note and a last will and testament that they show on UM briefly is left. Of course, again, they don't read it, so I paused it so I could read what it said. Mm-hmm. And the part that they show says, they will notify my godmother, who is 92. I have no other family. I cannot continue or renew at 52. Financial difficulties are beyond repair, and I am tired. Stack tells us that 2 weeks later, in a swampy remote area of Fripp Island, a man's body was found. It appeared he had shot himself in the head. An antique gun was found just a few inches from him, and it belonged to Ellen Barry. And the saddest part, a dog had also been shot in the head and lay nearby him.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yeah, he killed the dog, too.
What the hell?
The man had no ID on him, but he did have Mrs. Barry's credit cards. So the body was partially decomposed, and they just had people at the hotel that would have been people who had seen him before. Mm-hmm. So they had a security guard come out to identify the body. And the guard tells them, like, from the best he can tell, like, with the decomposition, it does look like the man who said he was Dan. Mm-hmm. For me, I was like, wait, hold on. There was a dog? Like, who's the dog? What's going on with the dog?
Yeah.
And I just thought that was weird. But then in my research, there are multiple references to Tondebald having a dog that he would take around with him.
Oh,
so,
no.
Yeah. So, again, I don't know if this dog was his dog, but that's what it appears to be in this scene.
So he presumably killed the dog and then took his own life.
Yes. Mm. The county coroner, Kurt Copeland, says it was all circumstantial at best. Like, you know, it looks like a thing for sure, but they don't have a lot. So he said they had discovered no social security card or driver's license, and they discovered that he actually never had had either one. So apparently then they cremate the body shortly after this because the note they found said that's what he wanted.
Oh, he doesn't get to do that.
I know. So the death is ruled a suicide. But Stack says not everyone believed that Dan Tondebald was who was found in the swamp.
Yeah. Where's that chauffeur, baby?
Oh.
So Officer Smith from the police department again says he's not convinced that was Tondebald because no one that knew him identified him. He says the security guard had really only seen him in a moment where he was driving by a security shack. Mm-hmm. That's not good. That's who they had identify the body. That is not good.
And then they cremate him right away.
Yes. Pete Ballard says, of course, it's possible he killed himself. He just doesn't believe it. He says it just doesn't make sense to do everything he did to get as much money as he did in such a nefarious way, only to kill himself. Which I kind of disagree. Like, when you realize people are catching up with you and your funds are running out and things are getting harder and harder.
Yeah.
I don't know. I could see it happening.
Unless he had money stashed somewhere. Mm-hmm. Like, he took a lot of money. Where did it all go?
Seriously. Yeah. All to horses?
No. Yeah. No.
Yeah.
No.
So it was Pete Ballard that stumbled upon the classified ad for the chauffeur and noticed that the address was the guest house at Berrymount. And he says it's odd to have put it in the Charleston paper when he could have probably been able to easily find one in the area. And that's when Pete started to realize maybe he'd been searching for a lookalike. Mm-hmm. So he thinks that he tricked this lookalike into coming out, had him walk the dog, and then shot him as he walked away.
Oh, shit.
And I do think, like, it's good we're thinking outside the box, but that is kind of a big jump. Like, you're really kind of putting together something that you don't have a lot to show that.
I think before DNA, that was a pretty nifty plan.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it would be a good idea if that's what you were trying
to do. And he said that he wanted to be cremated, so he was like, oh, they're not going to check.
Yeah. The coroner says that no one reported seeing him with anyone, so he had no reason to believe that the man was anyone other than Tondebald. Like, no one else had said, I saw a guy or anything. Stack says the authorities always believed that Dan did commit suicide, but there was a rumor that circulated. Copeland says the idea is that Dan actually is Hugh Berry, Mrs. Berry's son.
Oh, yeah.
Who was supposed to have died in Mexico.
Oh. Because people were saying they looked alike and all that.
He says it would be an easy way for them to have him back, but get him off the hook for the murder of his grandmother.
Wow. The conspiracy theories in this.
The drama. Yeah. It is a lot.
I know.
Stack tells us that the fact that no official records could be found for Dan Tondebald lent to the story and fueled the rumors that he was Hugh Berry. But then they finally found Tondebald's resume amongst letters he had sent to Mrs. Berry. So the resume said his hometown was Las Vegas, Nevada. A UM researcher looks into it and finds a 1951 yearbook from Las Vegas High School. Dan's in the book. Oh, his name is Dan Tondebald. The book was from his senior year. He's president of the Thespian Club.
That tracks.
That tracks. He's an actor.
Yeah, he is.
And he's definitely not Danish. Right. So Stack says many who knew him thought his Danish accent was an affectation, but Stack says perhaps it was simply bad acting.
What an interesting one to choose, too. Like, that's not easy to do. You know,
it's not easy to do, but how many people
haven't heard it?
Have heard it.
Yeah, that's true.
That's true. Yeah. It's not super
like if he would have said Czechoslovakian, everyone would have been like, oh, yeah,
sure,
okay.
That's what that sounds like.
Yeah. It's not like saying you're French or German, so you can flub it a little bit and people won't call you out immediately.
That's
true. So we go back to Marcia Robinson, who says she still thinks Tondewald was supposed to be Mrs. Barry's son's replacement. Quote, but here was this little old lady left without any money. Mm. I mean, she is poor, but also left without any love. Mm. I mean, what does she have at this point? Nothing. A little harsh, lady, because Mrs. Barry is still alive and she can see this. But Stack says Mrs. Barry is now 97 and has lost most of her ability to communicate.
Yeah, because they don't even show her on the same
notes.
Stack tells us that she now lives in an apartment that's paid for from the interest on an endowment she made to University of Tennessee.
Wow.
And I forgot to put it in, but it was a lot of money that she gave to the University of Tennessee.
So then they're supporting her, like, because, okay.
Yep.
That's nice.
I know, it's such an interesting,
really nice.
That's super nice. They didn't have to do that.
Would never have thought. Yeah, totally. Huh. It's estimated that the amount Dan cheated Mrs. Barry out of is in the millions. Authorities believe that he transferred the money into European accounts, possibly in France or Denmark.
See, that's why I don't think he killed himself.
I know, girl. It's a flippy floppy one.
I don't think he killed himself. I think he killed I think it was the chauffeur.
So at first I was not finding much on this case other than, like, you know, I found Ellen's grave and a tiny bit of info on Ellen. But then I hit quite the jackpot in finding that writer, Damian Moore, for AmericanCrimeJournal.com. He wrote two very lengthy two-part articles. The first one's called The Legend of Dan Tondewald, Part 1. And the second one is called The Redemption of Dan Tondewald, Part 2. So, American Crime Journal is this independent media organization, and they have covered so many things. I saw a few different UM cases pop up on, like, the suggested underneath.
Cool.
And they were, like, there was, like, one from our next episode and stuff
I recognized when you said that from the next episode.
Yeah. This was written in 2018, and I am not kidding when I say that Damian Moore deep-dived this case.
Cool.
The first part goes into the backstory, so it's, like, full details on the Barrys and their wealth and Hugh and all that stuff. And then part two goes into Dan Tondewald's history, his relationship with the Barrys, all this.
Cool.
Throughout all of it, Damian Moore is also sharing his ideas and opinions about what happened. So it's very much like the way we do it, where we're like, here are the facts I found, and here's what I think about it, and here's my speculation, you know?
Yeah.
Pretty much everything I've got here is taken directly from his writing because literally no one else is writing about this. So I just took this straight from him. Quote, one of the reasons I featured the background of Ellen McClung Barry first is so we don't enter this story with an inherent bias that she is this nice, little, old, lonely lady taken in by some slick con artist. Ellen Barry was not some woman that depended on a man her whole life, and when her husband died, she had no clue how to function. She worked hard and played hard.
Wow.
She was an educated woman, passionate about antiquities, restoring homes, furnishing them with priceless art and artifacts, importing plants from the Mediterranean to build elaborate hanging gardens.
Wow.
She was a natural leader who ran charities, art galleries, closed real estate, and dealt in business in an era and region of the United States that was almost exclusively a men's club.
Wow, okay.
She was not an idiot. She was no sucker.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Totally gives you another perspective to that entire thing right off. She went to preparatory schools from elementary school to high school, then received a master's degree in college. Again, at a time when women really had no place in the workplace.
Wow.
Yet, she somehow commanded respect of high society.
Wow.
So as I mentioned, Damian Moore goes into a lot of it, and it's all very interesting, but it's a lot. So definitely go read that if you want to know more about everything.
Cool.
So after Damian Moore posted part one of his article, Dan Tondewald's niece actually contacted him.
Oh.
So he got a little bit of family perspective.
Okay.
Quote, after posting the article, his niece got in touch with me and was able to clear up a couple of things. And he mentions, like, he misspelled her mother's name as Donna, D-O-N-N-A, and it's really Donna, D-O-N-A. Mm. And I mention that now because I'm going to swing back to something later.
Okay.
Little is known about Dan Tondewald's early home life, who can speak as a direct witness to what occurred. However, according to distant relatives and thorough friends later in life, he often stayed at homes of friends and was kicked out of his parents' home shortly after graduating high school, and he never spoke to his father again.
Mm.
Basically, he was like, when I talked to the niece about this, she couldn't really confirm all that for me, but she did say that their relationship was strained. She said, my grandma, Leora Tondewald, always tried to make contact with my Uncle Dan, and for some reason he didn't want her to be in his life. Hmm. So according to the niece, Dan spoke to his mother a few times after the death of his father, but they never reconciled. So there's a whole thing about it in the article, but the backstory here is that Dan was gay, mm-hmm. which we could probably tell from that mm-hmm. ad that he put in the paper. Mm-hmm. And Dan's parents didn't approve of this, so this is likely why their relationship was strained. Mm-hmm. Then there's a whole other crime in here. Saturday, January 2nd, 1954, 20-year-old Dan Tondewald was arrested and pled guilty on January 13th to extortion. So he had extorted this baking company guy at this bakery for $1,200. He was like, I'm going to write a series of letters that will ruin your bakery unless you pay me.
What?
It's very weird. And so, the whole thing goes down. He goes to the baker and he gets this envelope of money that he said, address it to him, to Danny. And he would pick it up later that day. So he does, but the baker had filled it with mostly just slips of paper.
Mm, love it.
So the police caught him. He pleads guilty. And then according to a later article, he was committed to a mental hospital to receive treatment after that.
Hmm. Oh, okay. So, okay.
Huh. And some people were like, is that where he met Hugh?
Right. Yeah. Is that how he heard about
that's what
mom?
I was going to say.
Yeah. And I thought of that too, but there's nothing like confirming that. Mm. So sometime between 1954 to 1957, Dan moved to the Bay Area in California, and he had this really high-profile relationship with a man named Eric DeRainier. Eric was 54, Dan was 24. They were involved in the fashion scene and the fashion industry, so they, knew people, big wigs in fashion. So then let's zip forward to how Dan comes in contact with the Berries.
Okay.
Ellen Berry was a member of the Ladies Hermitage Association, and Thomas was a trustee, and they had an event in 1968. Dan is listed as a guest of the event. So we know for sure at that time they were in contact.
Okay.
So then, this gets confusing, but Dan was working for a company that Thomas was a part of. I don't know if he was a part owner or what, but he was an important person in this company.
Okay.
It was called Joseph Magnin Co. of San Francisco. They were opening a new store in Tokyo in 1973, and heading the team of Joseph Magnin Co. San Francisco was director of merchandise Daniel Sterling Tondewald.
Okay.
So they're involved in business back in the 70s. So it's unclear when Dan returns to the United States, but he was employed with them until 77. And then it's in 78 that mm-hmm. he comes to Berry Mount.
When Mr. Berry dies.
Yes. Okay. The niece basically just confirms, he kind of, the last time she saw him was 79. She remembers because she was pregnant. And that after that, he just kind of drifted away from the family, but the family really loved him. And during his time at Berry Mount, the family had no idea where he was, and they were concerned.
Hmm.
His sister Donna searched for him for years, according to his niece. Quote, my mother searched for him for years. She even went to a psychic trying to find him.
Hmm.
Moore writes a lot about the UM process, and in particular, interviews.
Mm-hmm.
And in this segment, interviews are mostly what we have to go by. He says that, John Cosgrove and the UM team would always have researchers and fact checkers. So for these interviews, they would have someone kind of look into it and make sure that what this person was saying was true
mm-hmm.
to the best of their ability.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all we know. And I think, part of that is legal reasons. We're going to make sure we're not defaming someone or whatever.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So, and he had an interesting perspective on that. And he was think about the alien segments and stuff. No one's going to come sue you about an alien segment,
Mm-hmm.
But you're this person's testimony.
Mm-hmm.
He just points out that we really don't have an opposing interview with anyone who knew Dan Tondewald.
Yeah.
To share their experience. And we can give benefit of the doubt that UM did their due diligence, but we don't really know.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
He says, in one of the DVD commentaries, John Cosgrove actually summed up precisely what I was attempting to convey. He said, the interviews were so important to the way Unsolved Mysteries was produced. People would think that the most important thing was the recreations, but really having articulate people who can summon up the emotions of what it felt like was key.
Of course.
Director Kiva Rosenfeld later stated, you trusted the interviews. If you didn't have that, you didn't have a good episode.
It's true.
There was no one. Dan was dead. We have no one from his corner saying anything else to follow up on what these other people are saying. We know that the Barrys knew Dan Tondevold at least since 1968. He came across to them professional, intelligent, good-looking. He carried himself as a successful socialite and a wealthy businessman. He amazed them, and he was in their likeness, in their image. Mm-hmm. So we do know for an absolute fact that Tondevold didn't just show up at Barry Mount one day, like UM is saying.
Yeah.
He did have this plan to write a book, and Mrs. Barry said, come stay at Barry Mount. You can live out of the guest house. He could help her. Like, that was part of them talking about it. He was like, I can come help you manage your finances and operate Barry Mount. And most importantly, companionship. Yeah. Like we said before, she was probably suddenly very alone.
Yeah.
So what Unsolved Mysteries fails to tell us is that there was a 7-year period that he was living there with her before she signed over power of attorney. So it wasn't like this very sudden thing that UM makes it seem. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then he also pointed out that Ballard, Pete Ballard, who was supposed to be this very good friend of Ellen, said that he had only met Tondevold a few times in passing over 7 years.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, was he really that close?
Huh.
And then his biggest point that I thought was interesting was that there are not any records of the money moving around. So there's no documents showing this transfer of funds they talk about. He tells us there's not really any documentation provided on the show about what Mrs. Barry's funds actually were, like you said earlier. He also explains that before Mrs. Barry died, the Barrys were making their money by flipping houses. They would find small homes on mountains and turn them into giant expensive estates. And this entire business stopped when Mr. Barry died.
Mm.
Not to mention, Tondevold and Mrs. Barry are both used to living this really, like, high life and just spending, having million-dollar hobbies, etc. He also notes it as strange that Mrs. Barry would have come home to a house with all the utilities cut off, never filed a police report, never filed a lawsuit against Dan's estate, nothing.
Oh.
He says this would be public record, and he's certain that if this were out there, it would have been on UM. So the author says at worst, what we can tell is that Dan Tondevold helped Mrs. Barry spend all of her money. We have no evidence that he didn't spend his own alongside her.
What?
You know, he's like, they've got this lengthy 20-year relationship. He lived with her 7 years before this all, you know, before he got signed over power of attorney. He was wealthy when it started. He was young. He was gay. And he spent 7 years living with this old lady on top of a mountain.
Wow.
Like, that's a very unlikely long con. So.
Huh. Yeah. Wow.
When I read this, I was just like, whoa. Like, it, like, flipped my brain around.
Yes.
So, and then one more quote. I'll add a final and probably the most crucial caveat that perhaps will put an end to this once and for all. Tondevold's redemption. In April of 1982, Dan Tondevold became Ellen's power of attorney. Legally and technically speaking, he no longer needed her signature for anything. Tondevold would take out lines of credit, mortgages, second mortgages, reverse mortgages, et cetera, et cetera. Why would he wait an additional 3 years and spend thousands, possibly millions of more dollars? Why blow a million of those dollars on horses that he wouldn't be keeping? A significant waste for someone planning on defrauding someone he was already power of attorney over, yet burning a million of liquid cash.
Hmm.
For some so greedy and nefarious, it's hard to imagine he'd allow Barrymount to go for a paltry $85,000.
So he thinks that Tondevold just spent the money and didn't realize that there was no more money coming in.
Yeah, he said it's not hard to imagine that two people with a full-time staff and no income could burn through a chunk of money over 7 years, especially if you've blown $1 million on Tennessee Walkers. It's really hard to imagine that Ellen Barry, perhaps the only family that Don Tondevold felt he had at that point, was months away from financial ruin, and Tondevold took her on a final trip, hoped to find suitable replacement, and spent every last dime before he took his life.
So he's saying, too, the ad for the chauffeur was someone to take care of her after he was gone?
I don't know. I don't know about that
part. Yeah, what is the replacement part?
Yeah, what is the replacement part mean? Maybe that's what he's insinuating.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's a great angle. I do think, like, law enforcement did suspect that he had money in offshore accounts, and I feel like they would have had to have gotten that information from someplace.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. And, I mean, we do see, especially in a small town like this, we do see people that are victims of fraud not calling the police. So mm-hmm. maybe it was more just anecdotal, like they had the police come in.
Yeah.
That, I mean, that doesn't surprise me, but it's definitely an interesting theory.
Yeah. And then he also talked about, like, everyone saying basically that she was, like, dirt poor at the end. And he says, in the end, contrary to Pete and Ellen's standards, she certainly didn't live the rest of her life in squalor. Mm. So, like, I think compared to a giant estate atop of a mountain mm-hmm. with a live-in staff and a Mercedes, mm-hmm. she's suddenly living in an apartment by herself. That's not squalor. Like, she was fine. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's just...
Wow.
Weird.
She passed away in 1992 at the age of 98.
Okay.
And we still just don't know if that body on Fripp Island was or was not Dan. Yeah. And he's never been located.
Wow, that's a good segment.
That is crazy. Yeah.
That's a head scratcher, huh?
It really is. Like, I thought he didn't kill himself, but then
maybe he did.
I don't know.
And, like, I'm kind of in between after reading more stuff because I agree. I don't think he was, like, maybe necessarily trying to rob her blind. Mm-hmm. I think he was just spending a shit ton of money they didn't really have. And, like,
yeah,
I don't know. But then the suicide note, like, we don't know. Did he really write that? Like, there's so much weirdness.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's really good.
Yeah. That went in, like, a bunch of different directions.
Yeah.
Huh.
I did find a couple of things on the message boards. There was just one person that said that they worked at one of the hotels he would frequent in Charleston and that he would come in, spend money like crazy. He would buy the staff gifts from, like, Polo and Neiman Marcus. And he would just, like, take everybody out to expensive dinners, drive around in this Mercedes. Like, he was very charming and eccentric, and he would just spend.
Wow. All right. Well, then that's a good theory, then, that he just spent the money with her.
Yeah. And then there was one comment from someone named Desiree, and she said, Dan was my great uncle. I remembered hearing stories, not these, of course, from my grandmother, Donna, spelled with one N.
Okay.
Tondevald, so I think this is real, because mm-hmm. who spells Donna like that?
Yeah.
And my mother growing up. Then this aired. It completely changed the stories I heard. Crazy.
Whoa. Wow.
Oh, yeah. And sorry, one more person who knew him. The dog's name was Lord Chippendale.
Oh, yes, of course it was.
Of course it was.
And she was of the opinion that he would have killed the dog because in his mind, he would have said, nobody could ever love this dog the way I could.
Ooh. Whoa. I don't love that. Okay. Wow.
I don't know.
Wow. That was a really good segment. I do think it's really sad, though, that UM said that she was 91 and not able to communicate and that she lived to be 98. That's really upsetting.
Yeah.
That's 7 years of not really being able to communicate. That bums me out.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that was the length of time she lived in that apartment, too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
No, it's sad.
It's a sad story, but God, it is really interesting. He's either just like a guy that loved to spend money with his best friend who happened to be an older woman. Or he is a total con man monster who possibly hired a man that looks like him to kill him so that he could fake his own death and go live someplace with his offshore money.
Yeah.
And
like, either way, even if he did care about her, he was greedy as fuck.
Oh, yeah. Either way, he loved that money, honey.
Mm-hmm.
Either way.
Good job.
Good work, girl. That was fun.
Yeah. All right, we're wrapping it up with the Lost Loves. This is the case of Jim Curry, who is looking for his mother, and it's actually quite sad, as they often are. Mm-hmm. I guess I shouldn't be surprised. So the segment opens with a scene from March 1949 where a man who we find out is Donald Curry, Jim's father, is taking his young sons out of a house and putting them into a car. And the mother, Annie Curry, is crying and waving to them from the porch.
Mm.
And at first you think, oh, they're just going away. She's going to miss them. No, Stack tells us that the two are now divorced and Donald has been granted full custody of both boys and is taking them away for good from Annie. So then we see Jim Curry, and he's one of those two boys, now an adult, and he has not seen his mother in more than 40 years. He says, quote, "I was never given the sense that I could say how much I missed her or that I could ask questions like, where's my mom? She's a big question mark, and I would like to hear her voice. I would like to hear what she has to say about her life. I'd like her to know me." It's so sad. And then we find out that, coincidentally, Jim works. His job is searching for other people's loved ones because he's a senior investigator for the California Public Defender's Office, and he works to find family members of death row inmates.
Wow.
Which just, he's such a sweetie, and then when you find that out about him, it's like, oh my gosh, what a special person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He says, which I had never thought about this before. He says, "I've had adopted defendants before and had to find their birth mothers." It's just, can you imagine, as the mother who gave this child up for adoption, you haven't seen them, and when you're found, you find out that your child is on death row.
Yep.
It's unbelievable.
Horrible. It's just ironic for me that I can find so much about these people's histories and I can't complete my own. It's very frustrating.
Mm. I can't imagine being like, this is my job and I want it so much for myself.
Well, and it didn't give me a lot of hope that he knows all the ways to find people and he can't find his mother.
That's really true. That's very true.
So the details of his mother meeting his father are, in England in 1943, 23-year-old Canadian Sergeant Donald Curry met and fell in love with a British woman named Annie Fry, who was 19 and from Wales. He said, "My mother was described to me as being a socially upbeat person with a lot of vitality. She was a young girl, really." They married that same year, and soon she was pregnant. But in 1944, she was knocked to the ground by one of the bombs being dropped by the Germans on London, and it caused her to miscarry that pregnancy. So she became pregnant again, and Donald decided that it was safer for her to live with his family in Canada, in Vancouver, BC. So she moved there. But, of course, Donald is still in Europe fighting the war. Mm-hmm. So she's living in a strange country with her in-laws, who she probably had not met before.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And she has this baby that Donald has never met before.
Yes.
So on December 20th, 1944, Jim was born, and of course, life was really hard for Annie in Canada. When the war ended in Europe in June of 1945, Donald came home, and they were reunited, and things were okay for a while, and they had another son named Daryl. So then, of course, we know what eventually happens to the couple. So this is partly because Donald was greatly changed as a result of the war, and he closed down emotionally. Of course, he had PTSD. Jim says that his dad said to him, like, "You can't ever come back from watching your friends be blown up into millions of pieces."
No.
Like, but then there's so it's like Donald can recognize that, but then like there's no help for them.
No.
There's nothing for them.
And that must have happened to thousands of families.
Yes.
Thousands of them.
Yeah.
So he began working the night shift as a customs official, but was really distant and closed off. So while he was working, Annie became close to an older married neighbor, and they soon began having an affair. Yeah. Which it's not great, but she was so young and is looking for love and companionship.
Mm-hmm. And she's totally isolated.
She has no family. Someone who can't because he doesn't have the help he needs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really sad.
But a relative of Donald's found out about the affair and told him about it. And in 1949, Donald sued Annie for divorce and full custody of the boys, which he won. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of surprising to me.
I think when the other one's a cheater, it can often go that way.
She was a woman having an affair.
Yeah.
Back then. Yeah. Forget it.
But then he wins full custody. She wants these boys. She wants them. He will not let – oh, the judge said, you have full custody. You're in control of if you want her to be able to visit them. Donald says no. Then he gives the younger boy, Daryl, up for adoption.
Could you imagine being so mad at the parent of your child that you choose to give them to a stranger?
A stranger.
Just because she had an affair. And Could you imagine, despite your kid.
Yes, yes. And she was a good mother.
Yes.
It had nothing to do with just because you're a cheater doesn't mean you're not a good parent.
Yes. Like, the law should have stepped in and been like, wait a minute. You don't want this kid,
this son
she
has
does.
A mother. Yeah. Yes.
He doesn't so need a sad. New mother. He has a mother perfectly capable. She just happened to have an affair.
Yeah.
Ugh. Horrible.
It's horrible.
So he gives Daryl up for adoption. And before they move to Los Angeles, he lets Annie see Jim one more time. And Jim kind of remembers that visit, which is so sad as his last moment seeing his mother. They moved to L.A. Donald remarries twice. Jim was close to both of his stepmothers. Like, they were nice to him, but he still wanted to be with his real mother, Annie.
Yeah.
So after Donald died, his father, in 1989, Jim began searching for both Annie and his brother, Daryl. And he was able to locate Daryl in Vancouver, Stack says, and reunite with him. But he has never been able to locate Annie and is still searching for her. And Daryl had no interest in finding Annie.
Yeah.
He felt loyal to his adoptive parents.
Yeah.
So that's why he's not featured in this segment, which is kind of sad to me, but whatever he needs to feel, because that's a trauma that he suffered. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. So we hear that Annie is 5'2 with a medium build and speaks, of course, with a British accent. She apparently remarried in 1951, but that marriage also ended in divorce. So she could be using the last name McDonald from her second marriage or have gone back to her maiden name of Fry. And Jim believes she may be living in the United States, Canada, or England.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. He has three different countries that he's got to work through now. The paperwork and the bureaucracy and badly
and
kept
name
records.
Changes and wartime records.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I searched and searched, and it's so sad. But from what I can tell, Jim, after the broadcast, was put in touch with a distant relative of Annie's, his mother. And the relative said that she had been searching for Annie's kids as well, but the relative did not have contact with Annie. So she was not able to put Jim in contact with Annie. The relative just knew that Annie had had kids that were taken away from her.
Mm. Okay.
So as far as I can tell, Jim remet his mother.
Oh, no.
And I can't even find Jim or Daryl at this point because I wasn't clear if Jim lived in the States or if he also still lived in Canada where he was born.
Right.
Just like finding Annie is hard, I think it's hard to find them too because of the multi-states and
countries.
Fairly common last name.
Yeah.
Multi-country.
Oh, no.
So, and common first name. So, yeah, that was truly it.
Oh,
all I could find.
I mean, you were right, though. If he couldn't find
her. It would have been a real shot in the dark with UM finding her. I mean, that's his job, right? Is to especially he can find adopted parents. So wow, that is it's so sad.
I just also really wanted it to be good.
What like a challenging thing for Jim to have a relationship with his father.
Yeah.
Knowing that his father gave his little brother away.
Yeah.
Knowing that his father, his only goal was to keep this, his mother and he apart. Mm-hmm. And then to yet still respect his father enough to wait until after he's dead to start searching for her.
I know. It is really layered.
Wow. Emotionally complicated situation.
Yes.
Wow. So that's a heartbreaker.
That's not a good ending, Lost Loves, and they're usually happy endings.
And usually we can at least find someone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Someone. Nothing. Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sorry. That's frustrating. Sad.
Yeah.
All right. Things to share and things to feel. What do we got?
I have something.
Do it.
We are recording this on the 20th anniversary of September 11th.
Yes, we are.
And I started listening to the podcast called 912.
I was curious about that.
Which is
I haven't heard of it.
Oh, my gosh. It's so good. I found it on the Wondery app, but it says it's an Amazon original and Pineapple Street Studios.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
But it is basically just about like the aftermath of September 11th in so many ways. So like one episode is about the Muslim community or Pakistani community in New York, this one community in New York. Another episode is about just the question of, like, why do we put up all these 9/11 memorials? What does it mean to remember events like that? And how are we trying to, like, freeze this time, that time, instead of, like, remembering and also focusing on things happening right now and just, like, asking that question of what that's all about? It is so good, and the best part is that it's hosted by the same guy that hosted Running from Cops and Missing Richard Simmons.
Yeah, he's great.
Dan Tversky. So it is so good. Highly recommend.
Oh, wow.
Especially right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
I have a, well, I think we've talked about the show before, but the new season of What We Do in the Shadows has come back, and it is the best show on television. And I am so excited, and we watched the first two episodes. The last one came out last night, but I like to let like at least two build up, so it's not just like 20 minutes, and then you're excited, and then it's over.
Yeah.
But if you haven't watched it, it's based on like a mockumentary about vampires living in Staten Island, New York. It's created by the brilliant Jermaine Clement and Taika Waititi, I think is how you say his name. But they're both incredible writers. They're so funny. The humor is amazing. And the whole cast, every person in the cast is incredible. I'm fully in love with this show. And I'm going to rewatch this season probably four times like I did with the first two seasons. But I can't recommend it enough. It's like my favorite thing in the world right now.
How do you watch it? Where is it?
Hulu.
Yes. Okay. That's right.
It's on Hulu. And
great. Love it.
So it cracked me up when I saw that was your reco and the thing, because we are right now watching season one.
Oh,
and that was going to be my reco.
Oh my gosh, you guys finally watched it? I'm so excited. Yeah,
I think I mentioned this before on the show, but we had started it a while ago, and then I, as I always do, fell asleep in the first episode. So my husband was like, God damn it. Like, and then we just like didn't get back on track and watch some other stuff. So now we're finally like watching it. Two episodes a night. And it's so
Isn't it amazing?
Funny.
It's so funny.
Oh,
it's
I can't wait. Oh my God. So we gotta watch it.
Even thinking about it, I have like a big smile on my face. Like, it is just so good. It's so good.
Yeah. It's very much in the style of like The Office and that kind of thing. But set in this like darker world, and it's just really, really funny.
Yeah, it's incredible. Everybody in it is so funny. It's super quotable. It's just the best. It's the best. Yay. Yay, I'm so glad you guys are watching it.
Yeah, it's great.
That's awesome.
Great.
All right. Are we doing Review Corner? Do we have some reviews to Review Corner? Carlin, you want to give it a read?
Sure. Here's a little review for you from Patience Amber. And it is titled Millennial Perfection. It says, Resolved Mysteries is the first podcast I've ever become obsessed with and the first Patreon I've ever subscribed to.
Yay, thank you.
The hosts are the cutest, sweetest, most hilarious honeys, and their episodes always make my day better. If you are a millennial who loves 90s nostalgia, true crime, and liberal use of the F-bomb, this is the podcast for you.
We are. Yay.
Nailed it, Amber.
Oh, Amber, thank you.
Okay, so episode 13 is next. What are we covering?
So in part one, it's going to be a two-parter because there's four segments. So in part one, I have the unexplained death of Chad Maurer.
And then we have a lost heirs, Laureen Roberts.
And I have the wanted segment in part two of Todd Mueller, or is that his name?
And then I wrap it up with one of my favorite lost love segments of all time. The Vess family is looking for their lost little brother, Heath Vess. So please go to patreon.com/resolvedmysteriespodcast if you're interested in supporting us there. If you subscribe at the $5 a month level or higher, you're going to get ad-free episodes, two extra episodes a month, and other goodies in the mail. To see photos we reference in the episode, follow us on Instagram at resolvedmysteriespodcast and on Facebook and Twitter at resolvethepod. You can contact us at resolvedmysteriespodcast.com, resolvedmysteriespodcast@gmail.com, or at our P.O. Box 14005, Portland, Oregon, 97293. Send us your stories for listener short stack episodes. If you want to email us your favorite unsolved mystery story, cold case, any nostalgia you have surrounding the show, or some spooky stories for October, you can send them to our email or our website or snail mail. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, leave a 5-star review and tell two friends this week about our podcast. That's your assignment. Two people. For every review we receive, we donate a dollar to an organization, and this month's organization is all the way at the top of the page, and it is the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, suggested by our patron Matthew. And that's it. We love you guys so.
We love you.
We really do.
Happy spooky season.
Happy spooky season.
And we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
This is just a 3-part episode. One, we don't have to do part one. Nope. Let me say that again.
I think the listeners would prefer if we did a part.
No, I'm on strike. I already did it, and it was my fault, and I'm not fixing it.
It's no one's fault.